You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available in both streaming video and as an audio podcast. And you are Catherine Mangu Ward. Is it Mangu or Mangu?
It's actually Mangu.
No, this is the second one I've gotten wrong in a row. Mangu, I didn't know that.
It's I'm told on good Romanian authority that I mispronounce it.
Oh, I see. But yours is closer to the Romanian pronunciation than anything I've generated so far.
Maybe. Who knows? As a second-generation American immigrant, I have no touch at all with my originating culture.
Well, congratulations. So. I encourage that. So it's Catherine Mangu Ward.
You got it.
Got it. Okay. So anyway, you are, among other things, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, which must be the most famous libertarian magazine in America, right?
I feel comfortable saying that.
And the most venerable. Did not Ayn Rand, and that's another name I'm probably mispronouncing, right?
One you got right.
Ayn Rand herself write for Reason Magazine?
She, her words did appear in our pages. She never wrote for us, but we did interviews with many greats from that era, including Hayek and Friedman and a bunch of others.
I see. And I assume that, and tell me if I'm prying, I don't want to, but in your home, do you have a shrine to Ayn Rand?
I do. I burn incense at it daily. It's a really important part of being the editor of Reason. No, I actually was, I started out like Reason started out as an objectivist.
Which means that's the name of her philosophy, right?
That's right. Objectivism is the name of her philosophy. I was a 15-year-old objectivist. I'm pretty sure I was terrible that summer. It wasn't until I got to college.
You've gotten less annoying since then.
That I can't speak to. I'm going to leave that up to your audience to decide. But it wasn't until I got to college that I read some other philosophers and also thought more broadly about politics and ended up with the libertarian label, which is the label that Reason also bears today. It's our 50th anniversary year. We were founded in 1968. Wow. So it's, galas all around.
Wow. Nonstop fun in Washington these days. Let me give people a preview of what we're going to talk about, and then I want to ask you a little more about libertarianism. Before we talk about it, we're going to talk about, in some sense, what I guess is increasingly being called the psychology of tribalism. In any event, the kind of trouble people in the different political tribes are having communicating. You wrote a piece for the New York Times, the physical New York Times, no less, the actual whatever they call the Week in Review now, Sunday Review.
Sunday Review,
with your own take on that, and we're going to talk about that. But let's talk a little more about libertarianism. Is there a thumbnail definition of what objectivism is? I mean, that's her own version of libertarianism, or it's a particular philosophical kind of backdrop for libertarianism or something?
So Rand herself actually hated libertarianism and libertarians and profoundly disassociated herself from them. I think that ship has probably sailed since her philosophy is pretty tightly entwined with American libertarianism as it exists in the 21st century. But, what Rand stood for was individualism. She was not uncritical of markets, but she was generally in favor of voluntary exchange rather than the use of force. And she also generally stood for rationalism and rational argument about everything. So, I think a real dyed-in-the-wool objectivist would probably object to four or five different things in that characterization, but that's at least a soft layman's version.
Well, that sounded pretty consistent with libertarianism as I understand it. So what part of what she considered libertarianism did she not like?
I think it had to do in part with the compromises, right? So American libertarianism, particularly as it existed when she was alive, was a little bit of a strange creature. It was certainly more entwined with the American left, in particular, the kind of like draft card burning and that sort of thing, which I think aesthetically and culturally weren't really her jam. Ayn Rand did not like hippies, and libertarians have room for hippies at the party. So again, certainly an oversimplification, but that's at least a piece of the conflict to the extent that it exists.
Well, that gets to the fact that different libertarians have kind of different hobby horses or different motivations, right? You've got your like gun people, your Second Amendment libertarians, you got your drug libertarians, you got your economic philosophy, Hayekian or whatever libertarians. It is in some ways a diverse group.
Yeah, and reason actually tries to be, to the extent that this is a real thing at all, a big tent libertarian outfit. You know, if you think of the sort of golden days of National Review, part of their explicit mission was to say who's in and who's out of the conservative movement, right? Bill Buckley was sort of a gatekeeper. Reason functions a little differently in that even though we are kind of the premier opinion magazine associated with our ideology, we often will publish people who wind up in different places as long as they're starting from what we see as fundamental libertarian principles. So an interesting example of this, just to dig right into some controversy, is that there are libertarians on both sides of the debate about whether or not a baker should be required to bake a wedding cake for a gay wedding. And it sort of depends on whether you see it as a free association issue or as a free speech issue and where exactly the lines get drawn. But we've published arguments on both sides of that because to us, it's an interesting conversation for libertarians to have amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I don't live in Washington anymore, but when I moved there, I lived there for a while. I moved there in the late 80s. Libertarianism, I think, was then thought of more as a fringe thing than it is now. It was just coming, you know, I mean, like Newt Gingrich was showing up and he was kind of citing some libertarian ideas and so on. So it kind of started to enter the mainstream. And I'm wondering, to what extent is that due to libertarians themselves or some of them having evolved a little toward more centrist or more conventional? You know, I mean, for example, Brink Lindsay came up with this idea of libertarianism, where it was a kind of an explicit compromise with liberals. It's like, okay, we can live with a certain amount of like welfare state and so on. And I know that, you know, when it was, you know, Obama, when Obama first ran for election, I started noticing some libertarians, like Will Wilkinson, who preferred him to the alternative. On the right. And so has libertarianism, which has changed? I mean, first of all, am I right that it's become more acceptable, more closer to mainstream legit? And secondly, if that's true, what has changed, the mainstream or the libertarians?
So, I mean, I think that, that Brink and Will's work is really interesting. I would not say it's particularly representative of where libertarianism is headed or where it's evolved in recent years. They're sort of doing an interesting experiment in left libertarianism. But overall, I think something different is going on, which is that I think the, you know, between the 80s and now, Americans have become pretty disillusioned with the mainstream political parties. That's pretty well documented, that more and more people identify as independents. And that's at least in part because they feel like the things they believe don't fit well into the red box or the blue box. A lot of those people have looked to the word libertarian, if not necessarily everything that I would say libertarianism means, as a refuge from those other categories. But I also think the world has become more libertarian. I mean, Reason in the 70s was publishing articles about legalizing gay marriage, legalizing marijuana, tons of stuff about policing practices and the need for criminal justice reform, asset forfeiture in particular. And that's all stuff that seemed totally insane at the time, right? It was like, you sweet, baddie libertarians with your crazy ideas about your legal weed, that's adorable, but now let the grown-ups talk about politics. And in fact, those things are all political realities now. And, you know, other ideologies came to those conclusions from different places, but they got to the same place. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't say libertarianism has triumphed and we now live in the libertarian world of our dreams. But I do think in many ways, Americans have become more comfortable with the idea that the government isn't great at telling people how to live in their private lives. Of course, there are many, many countervailing trends, and there's sort of fodder for reason to write a new story every day about those countervailing trends. So again, I'm not saying libertarianism triumphant, but I do think some of the ideas that seemed kind of crazy in those 70s and 80s issues of Reason now sound pretty normal.
Okay. So one thing this does is establish your vantage point, because the New York Times piece you wrote is about the interaction of, you know, kind of conservatives and liberals, or certainly, I guess, Trump supporters and Trump opponents. I mean, first of all, I would assume the average libertarian is not, on balance, enthusiastic about Trump.
Fair.
Okay. I mean, you can think of things. And by the way, libertarians disagree on immigration, don't they? I mean, Ron Paul was a real restrictionist.
That's right. I mean, there is some disagreement. I would say more libertarians favor more open immigration than those that favor a more closed system. But there are those in the Libertarian Coalition who would say, listen, I favor open borders or more open borders in general, but given the existence of the welfare state, given, you know, the existence of other government programs that are problematic, it's not quite so simple. And I disagree with those people. I myself am strongly in favor of dramatically increasing all types of immigration. Mm-hmm. But it is a place on which you sometimes see some disagreement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, as for Trump's actual kind of policy, I mean, I would imagine that the average libertarian would not like the kind of authoritarian vibes, and to the extent that his alliance with evangelicals has led him to favor the constraint of lifestyle choices, they wouldn't like that. They might be fine with a tax cut, but on balance, not fans.
That's right. And you're actually seeing something, and Reason has struggled with this a bit. We like tax cuts, but we like tax cuts in the context of cutting government. And Trump has made it very clear that he's not going to reduce spending. Now, mm-hmm. he has reduced regulation in some areas, and libertarians are generally in favor of that. But the overall cost of government, and therefore the overall burden ultimately on taxpayers, whether it's now or later, is not reduced, and he has no plans to reduce it. So Reason actually finds itself in a slightly tricky position of saying, you know, these tax cuts aren't a great idea if we're genuinely not pairing them with any other reforms that are consistent with smaller government.
Now, some of the deregulation that I guess he hasn't actually, I don't know how much he's actually done, but some of that would be to the liking of libertarians.
That's right. And we, you know, we like in general that a bunch of his cabinet appointees, are looking to reduce regulatory burden. But even some of the folks that that I was pretty optimistic about going in, I mean, think of Scott Pruitt at the FDA, have proven to be in many cases more moderate or just slowed by the machinery of the state, which is not surprising, and haven't necessarily implemented the kind of sweeping changes that either their libertarian backers or their opponents, you know, thought they might.
Okay. With all that as preface, so you have kind of a theory of the case when it comes to kind of political polarization, psychology of tribalism. You wrote in the piece, the problem isn't just filter bubbles, echo chambers. In other words, these kind of, you know, technological, structural changes in the way that we communicate, or alternative facts. It's tone. So what, lay out what you mean by that.
Sure. So I think, you know, of course, the two parties or the many parties have always disagreed. They've often done it in a very vitriolic way, right? You only have to look to some of the very earliest elections where people were accusing each other of, you know, being traitors who were also, you know, disloyal to their wives and, you know, all kinds of things. Certainly, super harsh political rhetoric is not new. But I think there's a sort of self-reinforcing cycle that we are in right now that does seem a little bit different than what came before it. And that is liberal smugness and conservative trolling. And those are, you know, in some ways, those are both internet jargon, I guess. I mean, smug is somewhat self-explanatory, but trolling as this idea of kind of baiting your opponents by being a cartoonish version of what they think you are, is the way that I would describe trolling. And mm-hmm. it's you know, I say in the piece that I wrote for the New York Times about this, it's really not clear to me who started it. I think there's a certain amount of childish desire to say, well, if the liberals hadn't been so smug, we wouldn't have had to be so trollish, or vice versa. It seems like it happened gradually and it was somewhat self-reinforcing, but in some ways the fathers of both of those sides are Jon Stewart and Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, which I remember this thing on CNN. It's been a while now, so maybe you should remind people. So, well, first of all, let's remind them what Crossfire was. I mean, Crossfire was this left-right. There would be somebody on the left, somebody on the right. For a while, the right was Pat Buchanan. For a while, the left was Mike Kinsley. I was actually at the New Republic then, when he was, you know, he was at the New Republic and was doing Crossfire, and then left it to do it full time, I guess. But and then there would be a guest, usually maybe two, but the guests would be kind of cross-examined from the left and the right. One day, I guess the guest was Jon Stewart, right? So, because who was it? It was Tucker Carlson. Do you remember who was sitting on the left? Was that Mike?
Paul Begala.
Paul Begala was another lefty they used. Okay. And so Jon Stewart delivered a sermon, right? You want to?
Right. So he, you know, obviously he's a comedian, but he was increasingly at that time being taken as kind of a source of news and a voice of authority at the same time. He shows up on Crossfire and he basically says, like, you know, let's get real for a minute. And then he proceeds to scold both Carlson and Begala for ruining America because of the form of political discourse they're conducting. And he points to a bunch of things. He says, listen, there's this sort of both sides-ism happening in your conversation where you weight everything equally and that's wrong. But he also sort of generally calls out the partisan tone of the conversation. And, you know, depending on who you listen to at the time, I think this was 2004, maybe, depending on who you listen to at the time, people tend to decide with their guy.
Let me say I was wrong then to say I was at the New Republic. I was conflating things, but go ahead.
And I may actually have the year wrong, so I'm not 100% sure. But
I wasn't wrong that I was at the New Republic. I was. It was just
at some point,
an earlier
honestly.
Period. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, what happens there is that, Jon Stewart establishes himself as sort of the voice of, you know, being above the fray and having a good perspective on it. And he says, you know, this type of discourse is bad. Now, at the time, people said, like, he's a truth teller. But in fact, when you look back, it seems to me, and it seems to others, including Gerard Alexander, who wrote a great essay about this in the Times a couple years back, that this is the moment when sort of smug liberalism coalesces around a certain style. This sort of, you conservatives don't even know what's best for yourselves. Your way of arguing is bad. Your underlying arguments are bad. You're probably kind of racist, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I think what's interesting is that Tucker Carlson, who has, you know, he has more lives. He has nine lives, right? The guy just keeps coming back with a new show, a new thing, whatever. And he's now one of the top rated hosts on Fox. And his style, if anything, has become more aggressively partisan and trollish mm-hmm. than it was in his Crossfire days. Mm-hmm. So we have the kind of smug liberal who has spawned dozens of shows like The Daily Show once was. And meanwhile, Carlson at the top of the ratings charts and the two feed on each other.
Yeah. Before we get more into this dynamic, the trolls versus smug dynamic, I want to say I'm not sure about Crossfire at the very moment Stewart did this, but in retrospect, compared to today, much of Crossfire was like, you know, a love fest. I mean, honestly, I remember that when Mike Kinsley and Pat Buchanan did it, they actually kind of liked each other and you could tell it. And also the other thing is Mike Kinsley and Pat Buchanan compared to, I think, most of the people you see on cable news now were like Einstein. I mean, they were both serious people who thought serious about their own ideology and its underpinning. And I suspect if you went back, you'd find that the cross-examination was pretty intelligent. Now, granted, if we're fast-forwarding to like Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala is a political operative, right? He's going to be a talking points guy. And Tucker Carlson seems to me like something of an opportunist. I don't know. you can weigh in as you like or not at all. But I want to say that at one point, I'm just trying to chart the evolution of America's decline into hell, where we are now. And I would guess that Stuart was not wrong to say that things were going badly by then, but that they probably weren't nearly as bad as they are now, which is part of your thesis.
Yeah, and actually a piece that I of this that I think is undervalued is that if anybody used to have a monopoly on smug, it was the right, right? I mean, if you go back further, so back, you know, well before this exchange, the kind of patrician, waspy intellectual mm-hmm. right certainly trafficked in smugness, right?
Well, that was absolutely. Bill Buckley seemed smug.
Right. And that was absolutely a charge that, particularly sort of progressive liberals or, you know, progressives laid at the door of the right, I think somewhat fairly. But at some point that switched. And, you know, I think where we are now is that, the sort of elevated tone of the golden age of Crossfire aside, you know, there's something different. There's something different about the way that partisan discourse is happening. And not least that it's happening. The discourse is getting worse at a time when policymaking is more or less stalled. That this is not sort of vitriolic language in the service of high stakes legislating. For the most part, it's vitriolic language that grinds everything to a halt.
Mm-hmm. And so you see this dynamic, this mutually, this positive feedback cycle between smug pronouncements that tend to be disdainful of the right, and that in turn trigger more kind of trolling from the right, which right. in turn triggers more smug disdain and so on, right?
Right. And I actually feel, you know, I am in many ways uneasy being a speaker for either of these sides, right? I mean, I'm a libertarian, and I see that as truly being not on Team Red or Team Blue. And so I feel a little bit awkward about saying, you know, here's what I think conservatives are up to and here's what I think liberals are up to, because, you know, in many ways I'm not fully a part of either of those conversations. But the very strong belief that I hear and see on the part of the left, which is that and, you know, this is embodied in or sort of best described in the great Vox piece about the smug style in American liberalism. And it basically says, as the Democratic coalition, as the middle of that coalition hollowed out, as it became, you know, coastal, super educated elites and mm-hmm. then people of color, and as the sort of unionized working class dropped out of the Democratic Party coalition and joined the Republican coalition, people on the left sort of perhaps understandably grumpy about having been abandoned by that demographic started to speak ill of it. Hmm. And that is the sort of origin of this particular subset, which I think is the most pernicious on the left, of claiming that the motivations of those people in particular couldn't possibly be good, or to treat them as not being in good faith. So it's assumed that they're either racist or they're essentially economic nationalists, because what else could explain their support for the Republican Party? When in fact, I think an effort to look at that demographic's political shift in good faith is, you can find lots of reasons why they might have abandoned the Democratic Party for the Republican Party that have nothing to do with being bad people or holding sort of beyond the pale beliefs.
Yeah, so let's look at some of those, because, I mean, I think you're right. Well, I think initially the reaction, you know, if you go back to the book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that it was just kind of befuddlement. It's like, don't you people understand that your economic interests lie with the Democratic Party? We're going to give you health care. We're going to give you, and so on. So there was that, and I even forget what his explanation was in that book. I'm not sure I ever knew, but I think... you're right that, and I think this is partly an artifact of Trump, of the age of Trump, where there is an attribution to this demographic, the kind of white working class, whatever, that's moved to the right, of racism, of xenophobia, whatever. I think that's very common. But in any event, what is your explanation for why they might rationally or understandably have switched party allegiances?
So I think there's a couple things going on. I think you know, I am a big fan of Jonathan Haidt, whose work on kind of the underlying personality and psychological factors of people's political affiliations is very powerful. And, you know, one thing that he says is, you know, people on the left speak the language of care or harm and justice or fairness. So they want to kind of help the least well off. They want to maximize utility. They want to do what's fair. And people on the right believe in those things too, but they also have other values. And those values, people on the left are typically blind to them. So they value in-group loyalty, right, which includes like patriotism, and they value authority. That, you know, if you cede to an authority, like for instance the head of your church, that there's virtue in that, and you know, or even the head of your party. And so I think some of what you're seeing in the white working class is that they speak those languages. They speak the language of in-group loyalty and authority, and they found themselves being badly received on the left when they spoke those languages, and well received on the right, which has always spoken those words. You know, I think again, this is a place where, as a libertarian, I'm thinking, well, the Republican Party used to say, yeah, we're not in favor of protectionism. We're not in favor of increasing entitlements. We are anti-union, and Trump reversed a lot of that. But that was always around, embedded, one might argue, even in the Tea Party, but certainly the sort of populist Republican upswing, was characterized by stuff that those white working class voters wanted to hear, mm-hmm. over and above anything like racism.
And are you saying the Democratic Party had become less amenable to that kind of, those kinds of values, respect,
yeah,
for authority,
sanctity? I think that, you know, the sort of Reagan Democrats, or even the sort of Blue Dog Democrats, had a way of talking about those things that was consistent with their ideology, and that fell away at some mm-hmm. point. And, you know, I should say, like, I'm pretty sure I don't understand those values on a visceral level, right? Like, libertarians are not really into loyalty and authority.
Well, I was about to ask that. And I've wondered about John's, you know, model, which is now kind of famous. I guess he laid it out in the book, The Righteous Mind.
Yep.
Like, if you accept that it's applying to politics at the moment, to what extent is he tapping into things that are true of conservatism in some generic sense? You know, that follow almost from the actual ideology, and to what extent is an artifact of the demographic constitution of right of center of the moment, right? And the first thing I thought is libertarians don't fit this model, and they are right. Thought of as more right than left.
So one thing that Haidt actually has written about is that, you know, he was using existing metrics, right? So he didn't make up this scale. He borrowed it from other, you know, psychological study uses, right? It was already around. And mapping it onto left and right had the problem that any left-right spectrum has, which is that some people don't quite fit easily on it. I think historically, because of the Cold War, essentially, libertarians had affiliated with conservatism, right? Like, we can both agree communism is downright bad. In the post-Cold War era, that falls apart a little bit more. I think nowadays, libertarians don't particularly have a lot in common with the American right, more than they do with the left. But Haidt actually eventually kind of added a corollary to these five principles, which was just liberty, just people who value liberty, and basically said, like, yeah, there's some weirdos that just value really, really high on, or just score really, really high on liberty.
And those are
libertarians.
That's just, yeah, like a third demographic, a third dimension.
Yeah. And I should say, I'm sure I'm not, you know, his work is very technical in some ways, and I'm sure I'm not doing it full justice here, but, mm-hmm. But yeah, essentially that he acknowledged that left-right spectrum doesn't have the capacity for some other measures that we care about. But, but, you know, for instance, another thing that he has on there is purity, is valuing purity. And you can see
that's a conservative
actually,
thing. Yeah.
It's a conservative thing, but there is a lefty version of it, right? Like, no one is just straight up one thing or the other. So people, right, on the left, they worry about BPAs in their plastic and GMOs in their food and, you know, vaccines in their bodies. And
right.
I mean, there's a real lefty variant of the obsession with purity.
So how does he deal with that? That does seem to complicate his model.
You know, he just says, like, listen, you know, everybody has some of this, but that, you know, mm-hmm. by and large, there is a deafness in the ideological clustering around the American Democratic Party right now, that's really very low on valuing anything besides care, harm, and justice, fairness.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, on liberty, basically, I mean, economic liberty is associated with conservatism, lifestyle liberty is associated with the left, with liberalism, and then libertarians, you would say, are consistent, therefore liberty across the board.
Right. Although I actually have found, so I used to say, you know, people say, oh, real quick, what is a libertarian? I used to say, you know, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. But I now find that people don't know what that means anymore, that people sometimes think socially liberal means favoring entitlement programs, mm-hmm. Because that's become so central to what it means to be a liberal, that they sort of don't even think about this question of like, oh, you mean, you know, drugs and abortion and, you know, whatever. And that likewise, people don't associate conservatives or Republicans in this country with fiscal discipline. Republicans have been terrible on that for decades now. So that description no longer works as well as it used to. And I think that's telling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So back to this, trolls versus smugs dynamic. I guess I'd ask to some extent the same question I ask about Trump's, about John Haidt's, kind of model. Like, to what extent do you find on both sides? I mean, first of all, smug is associated with disdain. It's associated with self-righteousness, and certainly there's mutual disdain, right? I mean, there's a strong sense of righteousness, at least, if not quite self-righteousness, on the right, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe I'm asking you to define as precisely as possible, like, what is this smug sensibility as opposed to the versions of kind of disdain and self-righteousness or whatever that you would find on the right?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I mean, you're talking about my people here.
I think in many ways, smugness as it's currently constituted is a form of trolling, right? I mean, Jon Stewart was quite aware that what he was doing was poking the hornet's nest, right? Mm-hmm. He was sort of parodying the views of the right, and not affectionately, as a way to get a rise out of them. And as I say in the Times piece, I think in many ways the lesson that people learned from Stewart's intervention in Crossfire was do as I say, or you know, was sort of do as I do, not as I say, right? That he was saying everyone should be calm and fair and nonpartisan, and let's talk about the real issues. But then he went back to a show where he was like, this conservative has on stupid pants. Mm-hmm. And that, right. You know, in some ways what the right learned was that lesson that, you know, you win through mockery and you win through kind of attacking the aesthetics of the other side rather than, on substance.
Yeah. I have to say, though I'm a liberal, I always found Stewart a little annoying. I found his Crossfire speech very annoying, and much of his, honestly, much of his, I never really resonated to his particular sense of humor, and you're right, the show, the premise was that everything conservatives believe is not just stupid, but self-evidently stupid. The joke was, isn't it obvious how stupid this is?
Right, well, and so this is actually a big piece of it, I think it is often a sincerely held belief on the part of people on the left, that if the people on the right just understood the facts of the matter, if they were just given the right data set and sort of, you know, put into a calm state of mind, that they would agree with liberals, right? That like it is a failure of understanding rather than a different set of values, mm-hmm. and that's behind a lot of Barack Obama's rhetoric, which to people on the left sounded like him saying, I want to give you the information. I'm going to open my hands to you. All I'm asking is that you take a common sense approach to policy or to politics.
And you think that pervaded his rhetoric? It wasn't just the bitterly clinging to their guns and religion remark?
I think it did. I often found myself chafing in his most statesmanlike moments, in his State of the Union speeches, in his inauguration speeches, these sort of almost asides where he would just say, like, I'm sure we can all get together and agree that I'm right. You know, and it was like, that's not compromise, right? Like, that's not, you know, to sort of say, I'm going to give you conservatives time to come around to my point of view is not a true compromise. And so, you know, as that was pervading Obama's rhetoric, people on the right got more and more fed up because they were like, listen, it's not that we don't get it. It's that we think you're wrong. It's that we think your values are wrong, that you are missing important moral things about how we should evaluate that information. And then this gave rise to the kind of, you know, both sides saying fake news, alternate facts, because, again, with the sort of pretense that the debate was about getting the right information, when in fact it's always been about different underlying values.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we talked a little about smugness. As for the trolling side, and of course there are trolls on the right and the left, but I agree that there's a distinctive kind of trolling that comes from the right. Don't you think that's largely a product of the alt-right? I mean, the alt-right really brought energy to the trolling business, right?
That is true. And I think, you know, one thing that I struggled with when I was writing this piece is, you know, I do not want to be a defender of the alt-right in any form. They are ethnic and economic nationalists. They stand against everything that I believe in. At the same time, I think at least a few years back, alt-right was a broader category that included people who just made dumb memes. You know, people who just were sort of screwing around on the internet. And like, were they being helpful? Were they like a great part of American political discourse? No. But were they actual Nazis? Also no. And like, as it turns out, some part of the alt-right were actual Nazis and they actually came out with their Nazi flags. And then we were like, okay, so this has gotten pretty bad. But, you know, I think that rhetorical shift toward using kind of memes and sort of exaggerated, jokey, and particularly in-jokey ways of provoking the left, that is not in and of itself something that, like, if you do that, you're a Nazi, right? And unfortunately, I think for reasons of a totally understandable, very strong political and cultural reaction to the notion that there were Nazis in our midst, it all kind of got conflated.
Okay. I mean, Trump is a troll, isn't he? I mean...
So Trump is, in the same way that Obama was the president of the smugs, Trump is the president of the trolls. And, you know, I think it's not a coincidence that President Smug gave way to President Troll. And the fact that it surprised conservative intellectuals in particular, you know, that Trump's ascendance was a shock to the National Review types of the world, and then that they stood against it, demonstrates that everyone underestimated the power of populist trolling, mm-hmm. right? That the right hadn't yet gotten accustomed to the idea that they did have this kind of white working class voter in their midst in a more substantive way. And the left hadn't gotten used to the idea that they couldn't take that voter for granted. Mm-hmm. And so the big shift that happened there was people sort of somewhat alienated by the smugness and drawn to a Republican Party that was not too persnickety about big entitlements and economic protectionism.
Mm-hmm. If you wanted to posit a beginning of this earlier than you posit, and this isn't exactly a troll versus smug thing, but I'm wondering, where do you think Newt Gingrich fits into this? He is often singled out as somebody who carried just gutter-level partisan warfare among politicians in Washington to a whole new level, and I think he really did make some important innovations in the art. But where do you see him fitting into all this?
So Newt is a little bit before my time, so I don't have like a visceral understanding of how he operated. My understanding, though, is that the difference between Newt's version of this and Trump's version of this is that Newt still did it. He operated primarily at the elite level, that he was sort of fighting it out on the Hill, but that he wasn't turning to the people, right? And the big difference with Trump is he's doing all his work on Twitter. That said, though, my colleagues and I actually had a pretty interesting conversation about the comparison between Newt Gingrich and Paul Ryan recently. So we do a Reason podcast. We release it every Monday. It's me, Nick Gillespie, Matt Welsh, and Peter Suderman. And
do you ever have guests from an alternative perspective?
We don't. We don't have outside guests for that. We do have – Nick does interviews for our podcast as well, but that Monday talk show is just us shooting the shit. Okay. And Peter and I were sort of saying – we had hope that Paul Ryan would be a model of someone who had many libertarian leanings, but had gone for the kind of get as much power as possible and then like do good with it strategy. And the fact that he had in fact done no good at all with it from a libertarian perspective was bumming us out. And Nick and Matt were like, why did you guys have hope about Paul Ryan? That's crazy. And then we realized it's because like Newt was their Paul Ryan. Like the like sort of older generation of libertarians mm-hmm. had those same thoughts about Newt Gingrich. Okay, he's a little mm-hmm. weird. He's not totally libertarian, mm-hmm. but he's going to grasp the brass ring and then he's going to, you know, make all these reforms. And so they had sort of had their innocence taken by Newt and Peter and I hadn't fully crumbled right. until
and,
the
and
end
Newt,
of fall.
Newt has turned out to be completely opportunistic in retrospect. Right. And I think, by the way, his trolling, it wasn't trolling per se, partly because social media wasn't available to do trolling on, had to do with his just penchant for hyperbole and his just kind of meanness and his tendency to play to a crowd. In fact, some of Trump's instincts, it's just that, again, he didn't have the social media to do the trolling on. So you I mean, if we're locked into this dynamic, and I think it's definitely, there definitely is some of that. Of kind of liberal smugness interacting in a vicious circle with right-wing trolling. You don't seem to have much hope, if I'm reading the New York Times piece correctly, that things will get better.
So the hope that I have is so I should start by saying I am typically skeptical of theories that rely on some kind of breakdown before things get better, right? And this is something you hear in Washington a lot. Okay, once the Republicans really get a walloping, they're going to go into the wilderness and rediscover their fiscally conservative roots. Or, you know, once the Democrats lose enough elections, they're going to, you know, get back to a kind of real core progressivism that animated the party in the early part of the 20th century or whatever it is, right? Like people have this idea that like if you lose bad enough, you'll learn your lesson. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any evidence that that's how things actually work in the two major parties. The thing that I take hope from is the fact that, you know, as we were talking about before, Americans really are increasingly not willing to be put in these boxes. You know, Gallup does this poll. They find more and more that people identify as independents and that even when you try to force them into the boxes, you say, okay, you're an independent, but who did you vote for? But there's still an increasing number of people who just will say like none of the above. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine a different set of political coalitions coming out of that slice, if that slice gets big enough. And, you know, here in D.C., the New America Foundation has done some interesting stuff, I think, with like transpartisanism. So it's not bipartisan. It's not something that Democrats and Republicans agree on because that's basically always bad from a libertarian perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get like a bill named after a tragic victim that passes with no dissenting votes, like that's rarely a good thing. But, transpartisanism is stuff like civil asset forfeiture where kind of
it can be,
yeah. You know, law and order types and social justice types can come together. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing. I'm sort of hopeful about that. But the American political system is so structured as a two-party system that, you know, even a pretty big swing block in the middle isn't necessarily going to swing mm-hmm. how the policy looks. So I'm generally kind of a pessimist, but I think the same broad cultural change that we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation where an idea that seems absolutely laughable 50 years ago is settled law or very nearly so now. You know, I think the hope is on a pretty macro horizon mm-hmm. rather than, you know, in the next election cycle.
Uh-huh. Who's doing that work at New America, by the way? Who's spearheading that?
You know, they just put out these papers every now and then. I'm not sure I could even say who does it, but I know like Mark Schmitz used to do some of it. I don't know.
By the way, you're overdue for a Mark Schmitz conversation on Blogging Heads TV.
You tell that guy to reply to the scheduling emails from your...
Is that true? Is Mark the one who's at fault?
Oh, my God. He's the flakiest email replier ever.
You know, I've noticed that about him. I don't think we should talk behind his back, but it's pretty bad.
We'll just send him the clip.
It really is. He could really use some improvement. So, I guess, tell me what you think of this diagnosis of what's wrong with some of the attempts to fix this problem. It actually brings us back to Jonathan Haidt. I was at a party in New York that he was at a couple months ago, and I won't get into details, but it was a party that was for the purpose of kind of talking about this stuff, but it was bigger than a dinner party, so a few people actually got up and talked for like 5-10 minutes, and he was one of them, and he said this thing like, so maybe what we need to do is just, maybe there's a simple set of rules, and I forget what the rules were, but it was like think before you tweet type things, it was like, you know, have self-doubt, it was like, if everybody would just do this. And I was thinking, I didn't get up and talk, but I thought, yeah, that would work if everyone agreed with you that the most important thing to focus on is the problem of political polarization and tribalism. If we could sell all America on the idea that that is the big threat, unfortunately, that is manifestly not the case. Almost everyone I see on Twitter thinks that the big problem is that their ideology is under siege or is not prevailing or whatever. And so it seems to me, part of the, you know, if it is true that actually, and I think it is in some ways, that unilateral disarmament, so to speak, is in your own interest. In other words, if liberals can be convinced that the smugness or various other things that I would say are tactical missteps on Twitter are actually helping Trump consolidate his base, right? If they can be convinced that it's in their political self-interest to do less of this, that seems to me like a more promising way to start to break the cycle. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I will say, though, that the response to my Times piece from people who could be labeled Team Smug has been the opposite of that. It's been like, well, listen, sure, maybe you're right about how this rhetoric isn't working, but what's our choice? If we see the truth and people on the right are so wrong, we can't but say it. Like, we have to say it. It's our obligation to say it. And so that path, at least in the circles that I travel and communicate, doesn't seem to be very wide open. I love Jonathan Haidt's work. I find his proposed solutions to be often a little bit weak sauce because it's a hard problem. Mm-hmm. Another set of his work, though, is something that he actually co-wrote a cover story with Lenore Skenazy for Reason a few months ago, which was basically about how to raise resilient children and how to create another, you know, the next generation of people who can kind of take their lumps and take failure and how right now our cultural and political conditions are so hostile to that. That piece of his solution is more compelling.
That's another thing of his. He wants no snowflakes in the next generation.
No snowflakes. But I'm not sure. That's true. I think that's actually would be helpful.
I'm not sure we have that much time, first of all, this is a good chance to plug this newsletter I put out with help, the Mindful Resistance newsletter at mindfulresistance.net, which tries to keep people in the so-called resistance, people who don't like Trump or Trumpism, keep them apprised of the ways in which certain rhetoric emanating from our side actually helps Trump and tries to keep them apprised of like just the way news is being processed on the other side, which there's often a certain obliviousness to, I think, on the left. So people should subscribe to that, as a growing number of Americans are, by the way. Anything else on your solution? We have like about 4 minutes left, if I understand your deadline. And I want to ask you quickly about just the Trump. But is there anything else you want to say about this problem?
I mean, I do think it's, as I say, I think it's a generational problem. I don't think it's the kind of thing that can be fixed by the perfect presidential candidate or, you know, a single issue where people will suddenly come together. I do think that for all I can tell so far, a lot of the trends about tolerance for offensive speech are going in the wrong direction to solve this problem. If we teach people that they shouldn't feel bad when people say stuff that they disagree with, that they have the right to not feel bad about stuff they disagree with being said in the public sphere, it's going to be really hard to have frank conversations in the public sphere. And so I am, I guess, pretty pessimistic about that. But in the long run, I do think, people are in general more inclusive and more open and, have a sort of expanding circle of humanity, and that all of that may come together, to counter what I hope is just a sort of blip of tonal awfulness right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And quickly on Trump, like, where do you see this thing, heading? Re-election, impeachment, midterm disaster, what?
I don't know, man. I didn't think Trump was going to win, so I've officially retired my Trump prognosticator until such time as he is no longer needing to be prognosticated. So I cannot satisfy you with a good prediction there. You know, overall, I think a good approach is to look at what he's actually done or what he actually can do rather than what he says he's going to do. Because if we look at what he says he's going to do, it's all apocalypse every day. And in fact, it's not apocalypse every day. It's just sort of bad-ish most of the days. And that's a big difference.
So has it worked out like not as badly as you feared the day after the election?
You know, I didn't have the full-fledged post-election hair-tearing meltdown that many people did, but I remain not optimistic about the Trump presidency. I also do think, though, that our checks and balances and our institutions have proven to be pretty robust. And so that's encouraging and kind of, you know, making it through the next mm-hmm. 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It was, I think the key part of the balance of powers that was spelled out in our Constitution is the special counsel part of the Constitution, where they
Huge.
Say, where they
right
say
the
always
there.
Appoint a special counsel when the president seems to be a creep.
Every time.
That is actually where some of my hope lies. Though it's not, of course, in the Constitution. Well, thank you so much, Catherine Manju Ward. Is that correct?
Still no.
What did I say? What is it?
Manju.
Oh. Okay.
It's all right.
I got
I
the
accept
U part.
Any pronunciation.
It's just that I went from hard to soft on the G. Manju Ward.
You got it. That's
I got
it.
I will never err again. So people can find Reason Magazine at, what is the URL? Reason?
Reason.com.
Naturally, and there's a Reason podcast that people have permission to listen to if they have listened to all of the Blogging Heads podcasts and have spare time. It's no worse a way than any other to spend time once you've exhausted the Blogging Heads oeuvre. So I recommend that. Anything else you want to plug? Twitter handle, anything?
Sure. You can follow me at KMangu Ward and follow Reason's account at Reason.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm going to get busy trying to get Mark Schmidt to sign up for another conversation with you.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.